This weekend, many of us will be enjoying fireworks of one kind or another as we celebrate the 4th of July, hopefully from the safety of a public park with professionals handling all those explosives. But perhaps we've lost something by allowing the experts to always ignite our fireworks on the 4th of July. William Gerstle says the best fireworks may be the ones we build ourselves. He's the author of books like Backyard Ballistics and Absinthe and Flamethrowers, The Art of Living Dangerously. And it's all about having safe fun with homemade firepower and getting back to a certain kind of human nature. First of all, Bill, happy 4th of July.
Well, thank you. Happy 4th of July to you.
And do you want to give any sort of warning? I mean, if we're going to be making fireworks on our own, is this a don't try this at home thing?
Well, I think it's a matter of levels. When I say there's certain things, of course, you shouldn't try at home. I mean, I'm not advocating that anybody builds a gasoline flamethrower and use that at home. But there's a lot of things that I think that could be done successfully, safely, and give a certain new meaning to the whole idea of fireworks and what 4th of July is all about.
Well, let's give some examples, because there was a time when everybody made their own fireworks in the Revolutionary War period. I mean, fireworks are us. I mean, the Second Amendment is all about having fireworks and guns and keeping it at home.
I'm not sure there's a big relationship between, you know, the Second Amendment and what I'm all about. I think, you know, basically what I like to see is the freedom to be intellectually curious, to actually go out and make things. And yes, some of the things you make may be a little bit dangerous, but if you think about it and do it safely and, you know, with care, there's really no reason why an individual can't have a much better 4th of July with homemade things and things that they purchase.
And these ingredients are available?
Well, let's take as an example, John, the idea of gunpowder, otherwise known as black powder. I mean, I think you ask most historians on the subject, and they'll tell you that black powder is the most significant chemical discovery in all of humankind. I mean, this is something that for, you know, 800 years was the only explosive available. And what I say, you know, well it's easy to make at home. I mean, it's not, the chemicals aren't difficult to get. The process for putting it together, for turning these raw chemicals into, you know, what the Chinese called the fire drug, the miracle drug. I mean, it's not easy, but it's not terribly difficult. And once you do it, you have an understanding of this wonderful chemical that's far deeper than anything you could ever get just by reading about it. So I'm a big advocate of being intellectually curious and going down sort of the path that most people are scared to tread. Because I think that if you do try it and you use common sense and you get a little learning in front of you, you could do these things successfully. And that's what my book is about.
William, being intellectually curious a valid defense in court for maybe a mishap involving homemade fireworks?
Well, I mean, is it a... Probably not. Probably if something goes wrong. And when I say homemade fireworks, I'm not advocating, you know, cherry bombs or any very large explosive. The largest legal firecracker in any state or any developed country is less than 50 milligrams. So there's really no excuse for putting together a whole bunch of black powder and lighting it off and then hurting yourself or doing damage and then saying, well, you know, I was intellectually curious. And that's not what it's all
right
about. It's not a matter of the size of it. It's more of a matter of being able to do it. So, you know, your question, is it a defense? Probably not.
But really what I love about your book, Absinthe and Flamethrowers, The Art of Living Dangerously, is that you describe a world that we live in now as kind of a Nerf world, where we live in this sort of padded cell of warning labels and don't do this and don't do that. And so much of human history is about actually getting your hands dirty and lighting stuff off and playing with stuff that maybe is a little bit dangerous. And we've lost that now.
Oh, boy. You know what? John, when was the last time you saw a public swimming pool or any swimming pool with a diving board? They hardly exist anymore because everybody's so crazy scared that, you know, somebody's going to get hurt or hurt someone else. And if you, you know, when I was a kid, you know, we had chemistry sets. I mean, there's a lot of people that had chemistry sets. They did wonderful things with chemistry sets. And, you know, you can't buy a chemistry set that has anything in it anymore that's the least bit interesting. Yeah, I kind of think we live in a world of you know, sort of foam-covered corners and everything's sterile and you know, can't hurt you. But that tends to make life a lot less interesting. At least that's what I think. And I think a lot of people feel like I do.
Who in human history do you think has benefited from a kind of fearless, no-warning-label approach to the world?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. I think about that a lot. I've kind of made a list over time of people who, you know, people who did great things, really important people who started out young experimenting, kind of going over the edge. And like for instance, Thomas Edison, you know, Thomas Edison, the great inventor, he started out his first job was on a train that went across southern Michigan. And he had a lot of time because his job wasn't very difficult. So he fixed up a chemistry lab in the baggage car of this train. And he did all these experiments. And that went pretty well until he blew up the baggage car and got thrown off the train. But, you know, besides young Edison, I mean, if you look over time, Francis Crick, you know, sure. One of the two people who discovered the DNA molecule, you know, you read his biography. Well, when he was a young man, he was a hellion. When he was a boy, I mean, he would blow up stuff left and right. His parents were always petrified that he wouldn't make it past puberty. But he did, and he went on to do wonderful things.
And Marie Curie did all those experiments on her own with nuclear materials.
Oh, that's right. I mean, Marie Curie, Amelia Earhart, Boris Yeltsin, B.F. Skinner. I mean, the list goes on and on. I made a list, as I said, of people who did these kind of crazy way out things as kids and went on to do wonderful things as adults. And I kind of think that if they didn't get that chance to do those things when they were young, maybe they wouldn't have done such great things when they were old.
Are any of the explosives that you recommend building in your book, Absinthe and Flamethrowers, The Art of Living Dangerously, capable of actually blowing up lawyers? I mean, they're the ones who write all these rules and keep the diving boards off the pools.
Yeah, I think that would be kind of a good idea. No, I take that back. That's not true. But, yeah, I mean, there's some of the projects. I mean, I actually show you how to build a flamethrower, and I think it's a really good flamethrower. Used well, it impresses your friends, and it's, you know, if you follow the directions, There really shouldn't be any problem with it. But I make no guarantees. I mean, things can go wrong.
Things go wrong? What, with a flamethrower? Happy 4th of July to you, William Gerstle, author of books Backyard Ballistics and Absinthe and Flamethrowers, The Art of Living Dangerously. And we've already got a response from you listeners about this. Growing up in the 60s, Mike emails us, in the Bronx on the 4th of July, smart car owners knew to park off the block once the sun went down. A spectacular homemade pyrotechnic known as doing the Brillo was part of the show in the streets we all enjoyed. To do the Brillo, you unwound a wire clothes hanger, fixed a pad of steel wool on the hooked end, soaked it with lighter fluid, lit it up, spun it wildly, and enjoy the bright orange sparks of molten metal flying in all directions. Man, that's fun. Simple, fun to watch, and in retrospect, dangerous. So, fireworks are great to look at, but what else is the best view in America for this 4th of July? We haven't been everywhere here on The Takeaway, so what are the places we still need to see? Crater Lake, Mount Rainier, the view from your home in Oklahoma? Tell us the best view in America and why at 877-8-MY-TAKE. It's in honor of the crown opening on the Statue of Liberty for the first time since 9/11. There's a great view. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.